Okay, so in the morning we were talking about the mass law. So the mass at infinity broken down into a black hole contribution involving the area and the angular momentum, and then all the stuff that comes from the matter. And then from here, in principle, what we can do is to differentiate everything in sight and end up with a formulation of a first law, which relates a change in the mass, and that's the total change in the mass at infinity, to changes that occur on the black hole and changes that would occur also in the matter distribution. Now, to derive this, well, it's not so bad to, give a proper description of the matter, the matter variation. That's where all the hard stuff goes in, and that's what, me, like everybody else, decided to skip. If we forget about the matter, then of course we're dealing with a Kerr black hole, and then we derive the first law expression for a Kerr black hole. So we're not getting anything different here, except that, when there is matter outside the black hole, we have to account for that. Now, the way to interpret the first law is, that's something worth thinking about, because the way we would like to interpret it is, here's a black hole, let's do some stuff on it. In the spirit of thermodynamics, we would imagine some kind of quasi-static process where the black hole maybe would acquire some mass, and then it would change in area, it would change in angular momentum, and then we would relate all of those changes into something that looks like a first law. So that's how we would like to interpret it. But the interpretation is a bit subtle, because all of this is rooted in the idea that the black hole is stationary. And if we want to change anything about the black hole, like throw in some matter or throw in some other black hole, for example, then we're certainly going outside the notion of stationarity. So something happens in time when we transform a black hole from one state to a different state. Now, that's not too unusual in the spirit of thermodynamics. We can think of those quasi-static processes that are so slow that they might as well be imagined to be stationary. But in the case of black holes, it's a little bit tricky to think along those lines, because, it's a very delicate thing to be dealing with a very slow change of a black hole when, as soon as you put something near the black hole, it wants to fall in with the speed of light. So it's not, it's not that clear that the quasi-static interpretation really holds. When you look at the actual derivation of the first law, well, that's not what is being discussed. So the strict interpretation of the first law is, here, two spacetimes, two stationary spacetimes containing a black hole and some matter distribution. So we have the first spacetime where the mass of the black hole is M, its area is A, and then the amount of angular momentum that it has, let's say A and JH. So that's the black hole description in the first spacetime, and then we have some distribution of mass around it, and then we have a mass that we'd read off at infinity. So that's the first stationary spacetime. And then we imagine a different copy of the spacetime where the black hole has a slightly different area. It has a slightly different amount of angular momentum. The matter distribution around it might be slightly different, and the mass at infinity is also slightly different. So the strict interpretation of the first law is, we have two stationary spacetimes that differ by little with respect to one another, and then we just, derive an expression for the changes. And when we work this all out, then that's the expression of the first law. So the strict derivation of the first law gives us that sort of very artificial construction in terms of two different spacetimes. And what we would like to do is to interpret it in a way that we have just a single black hole and a very slow transition, because we don't want to mess up the condition of stationarity from one state to another state. And this would be the difference, a way of characterizing the difference in the two states. So, and I think the interpretation by and large is okay. It's just that it's hard to, to be very rigorous about this. The sort of, quasi-static process interpretation of the first law is something that is more of a matter of conjecture, and, it's probably okay to think of it this way, but it's not, strictly speaking, what the rigorous formulation of the first law is telling us about. So that's something that I think is worth, you know, being aware of and thinking about. What I'm not going to do is to derive the first law in the way that I sort of indicated, that would be use this as a starting point and, you know, end up here as a consequence. What I'm going to do instead is to really think about a physical process where the black hole would be physically transformed from one state to another state by throwing some matter in. And there could be matter out. I don't really care about this. I really care about matter going from the outside in a way that is not required to be stationary. So we're going to break the assumption of stationarity, but I'm going to treat the whole thing as a perturbation away from a stationary spacetime. And that's the so-called physical process version of the first law, where we're really taking this point of view seriously, that what we want to do is to start with a stationary black hole, do some stuff to it, and eventually return to a stationary black hole and compare the states between, before and after. So that's what we're going to be thinking about. And what we're going to do is to introduce a stress tensor that will describe the flow of matter inside the black hole, and we're going to do something with it. So again, so the idea here is that we want to stay more physical, but we're going to do it as a perturbation. And that means that there's going to be some approximations that will be involved here. And we just have to, you know, keep track of this and think about it somewhat carefully. So here's where we're going. We're going to talk about a physical process version. And that's is where we imagine that the black hole is stationary. So let me draw the picture first. We have the event horizon. We imagine that there's going to be some value of the advance time V1 and some value of the advance time V2. So prior to V1, before V1, everything was nice and stationary. After V2, everything is nice and stationary. But, you know, in the meantime, we threw some matter inside the black hole, and the matter might have originated from some kind of space-like hypersurface like this. So we have a matter flow, and that's going to be described by a stress tensor, and a stress tensor is going to be thought of as introducing a small perturbation into the stationary spacetime that we started with. So the black hole is stationary before V equals V1, so some moment of time where things start to happen. After V2, but changes between the two times. So between those two times, we introduce some kind of physical change described by a flow of matter across the event horizon. And we want to describe, you know, the state of the black hole initially was, MH A. So basically, we want to describe the changes that occur between the final state and the initial state. Okay, so that's how we want to look into this. So it's not going to be based on that, and now it's going to be based on a perturbation of a stationary spacetime. I'm going to introduce what I call flux vectors. And there's going to be two of them. One is going to be describing a flow of energy, and the other one is going to be describing a flow of angular momentum. So the flow of energy is going to be the contraction between the stress tensor of the matter and the time-like killing vector. And here we're taking that sort of dual point of view. So we have an unperturbed spacetime, which is stationary, has the time-like killing vector and the axisymmetric killing vector. So those things exist as quantity that live in the background spacetime. And we have a quantity T alpha beta that, you know, we're thinking of as living in the perturbed spacetime. And then we sort of do a hybrid combination of background plus perturbation when we construct something like this. So we have that one, and then we have the one for angular momentum, which is the contraction of the stress tensor with the axisymmetric killing vector. So just to give an interpretation to these things, I'm going to go back to my simple dust model. And in that model, what we have is that the epsilon vector is going to be rho that multiplies u minus u beta t beta multiplies e alpha. And, you know, as we discussed previously, this over here is the energy per unit mass, which is conserved by virtue of the conservation equation, the fact that our dust fluid is moving along geodesics. So this is rho that multiplies the energy per unit mass. So this is a density of conserved energy that multiplies the velocity vector. And we see that this has, you know, the immediate interpretation in terms of a flux vector for energy. And then for angular momentum, well, it's basically the same story. Same story, we have rho that multiplies u beta phi beta. And this is the angular momentum per unit mass. So what we have here is a density of angular momentum multiplying the velocity of our, you know, fluid. And that means that the vector L is really describing a flow of angular momentum. So that's what we're going to be using here to describe the changes in mass and angular momentum as the matter flows through the event horizon. That's going to be captured by those vectors, and more precisely stated, it's going to be captured by integrals of those vectors along the event horizon. So those vectors are divergence-free, which is a great thing because that will allow us to use Gauss's theorem to prove something useful. So I want to say that I'll prove for one of them. This vector is divergence-free, so we can just do the calculation. So if we do the calculation, we get that we're calculating the divergence of T alpha beta, T beta. So I'll just write it with the indices like that. And then, of course, the first term, after we distribute the derivative, is zero all by itself because of conservation of T mu nu. And then for the second term, what we have is the multiplication of a symmetric tensor with an antisymmetric tensor because the gradient of the time-like Killing vector is antisymmetric by virtue of Killing's equation. So this is zero all by itself. And this is zero after multiplying, you know, the two things together. We have a symmetric tensor multiplying an antisymmetric tensor. So that that is zero all by itself, which means that indeed we have a vector that is divergence free. And that's good because that's how we can turn a local statement of conservation like this to a global statement of conservation. So unless we have these Killing vectors, conservation of T mu nu or the divergence-free nature of T mu nu doesn't give rise to a conservation statement that would say something like, you know, something evaluated at one moment of time is going to be equal to something evaluated at the next, you know, at a later moment in time. But with the Killing vectors, we can actually come up with those conservation statements. And that's going to, you know, be important in establishing a, you know, an interpretation for the integrals that we're going to be forming on the event horizon. So when we get a little bit deeper into this. Okay, so let's turn all of that into something useful. So let's imagine a situation that's going to be my, you know, my starting point here. Let's imagine a situation where we have two space-like hypersurfaces. And I want to consider the flow of that matter that's described by the T mu nu. And instead of, you know, sending it straight to the black hole, I just want to express the fact that as the matter proceeds in time, the mass that registered at one instant of time is going to be the same as the mass that registers at the next instant of time or at the later moment in time. So I want to turn that divergence-free equation into a statement of conservation for some quantity that obviously we're going to be interpreting as mass or energy, and then angular momentum. So those are the densities of energy and angular momentum, and we want to turn that into global conservation laws for total mass and total angular momentum. Right, so what I want to, so I'll define something first. I want to define, so the mass, let's call it mass energy, because we're really talking about a density of energy here when we consider that quantity. So the mass energy crossing a space like hypersurface sigma, I'm going to define that to be the integral over sigma of the epsilon vector. And basically, the definition comes from the fact that, well, you know, we're clearly taking the energy density here, the energy density vector, and integrating it over a complete hypersurface. And then, you know, with the interpretation given to this, it's pretty sensible, I think, or pretty plausible that this gives us a notion of total energy that crosses the hypersurface at a given time. And then we're going to have, you know, the same quantity describing the amount of mass present on the second hypersurface at a later time. And the interpretation of this is going to be, you know, reinforced by the fact that while the mass that registers at one time is, you know, precisely equal to the mass that registers at the second time. So that divergence free condition translates into a conservation statement for this. And then same with angular momentum. The angular momentum that's registered crossing the space like hypersurface sigma at that moment of time is going to be the integral of the vector L. So again, coming from the local interpretation of the flux vector and after integration, turning that into a global interpretation for the integrated quantity. So what I want to say is that we have conservation statements. So let me come up with notation here. I'll call this delta M, and I'll call this delta J. And the deltas are suggesting here that because we're treating the matter perturbatively on top of a stationary space-time, the amount of mass that we can allow to be present in that discussion has to be limited. It has to be small. And the delta notation here suggests that we are dealing with a small perturbative quantity. So that's why I'm putting deltas on top of these things. But, you know, in the end, it's going to be the same deltas that we're talking about over there in the formulation of the first law. So the conservation statement, well, that's simply the statement that the mass at some hypersurface sigma 1 is going to be the same as the mass on a hypersurface sigma 2, and same thing for angular momentum. So the fact that the background spacetime is stationary and axisymmetric guarantees for any T mu nu, it doesn't have to be the dust model that we're talking about, but for any T mu nu, that we have conservation of mass. Stationary means that the mass here will be the same as the mass there, and axisymmetry means that the angular momentum here will be the same as angular momentum there as the matter flows from one hypersurface to the next. And having established this, and I will establish that in just a second, then what we're going to have here are, again, plausible definitions for how much mass and angular momentum is going to be crossing the event horizon if instead of that hypersurface, we're talking about the one provided to us, you know, the null hypersurface provided to us by the event horizon. So that's how we're going to be getting to the calculation by applying those definitions to the flow of mass and angular momentum across the event horizon. All right, so to show that this is true, well, all I have to do is to apply Gauss's theorem. So what does this theorem say? Well, the theorem says that if we have some region in space-time and we want to integrate the divergence of a vector field in that region, what we can do instead is to do a closed integral on the boundary of the vector field itself. So that's the statement of Gauss's theorem, with the usual warning that the unit normal that's involved here, or the normal vector that's involved here, is the one that points out of the surface. So what we would want to do here is to apply this to some closed region where I'm going to take those two hypersurfaces here and think of them as extending all the way to infinity, and I'm going to close the boundary by drawing segments at infinity. So we have sigma 1, we have sigma 2, and my matter, I imagine, is bounded. So it doesn't matter how far I need to go as long as it's outside the matter distribution. So I'm just going to close this off and think of this as being contributions at infinity. And then the union of all those segments here is going to be my boundary for that closed region in between. And then when I rewrite everything in terms of sigma 1 and sigma 2, the only thing that I have to be careful about, and that's reminiscent of what we talked about this morning, is the fact that the unit vector that's involved here is the one that points out, which means that on sigma 2 it points to the future, but on sigma 1 it points to the past, because it has to point outside of the enclosed region. So I don't want to stick with this convention. What I want to do instead is to introduce an n2 vector that's going to be pointing toward the future, and an n1 vector that's going to be also pointing toward the future, which means that my n1 vector is going to be opposite to the n vector, and that will be introducing a minus sign, the same sort of minus sign that we saw in the discussion this morning. So in our application, what we're going to do is to pick either epsilon or L as the vector here. And in both cases, we're going to have a vanishing divergence. So 0 is going to be equal to a surface integral over the closed boundary. And that will translate into a contribution from sigma 2 minus a contribution from sigma 1. And that will give rise to those statements. So I don't think I need to spell this out very accurately. I'll just do the calculation for epsilon. So the integral of the divergence of epsilon is 0 because the divergence itself is 0. And when I rewrite the boundary integral, I'm going to split it into a contribution from sigma 2 and a contribution from sigma 1. I'm assuming that there's no matter at infinity, so I don't have to include those contributions. And what I'm going to have here is the epsilon vector. And remember that this, for a space-like surface, that's equal to minus n alpha times the scalar volume integral on the hypersurface. So I'm going to put that minus sign in front. I have n alpha. And here, n alpha agrees with n2 alpha, because they point in the same direction. So I'll just indicate this with a 2, indicating that my n2 vector is the normal vector to the hypersurface pointing to the future. And then we get this. And that's the same thing as what I was defining before for delta m on the sigma 2 surface. And then here's where the minus sign becomes necessary, because when I go to sigma 1, I still have minus n alpha here, but this minus n alpha will be replaced by a plus n1. And the minus minus gives me that plus, so I'm writing it as n1 alpha d sigma, and that's the contribution from sigma 1. So with the right flip in normal, so the change in convention that we get here, we get the statement that the integral on sigma 1 is equal to the integral on sigma 2. And that's precisely the statements I was making here. So that gives rise to the integral over sigma 1 being equal to the integral on sigma 2. And that's going to be true for the epsilon vector. That's going to be true for the L vector. So that is the mathematical proof that we do have conservation statements like this. So bottom line, when you have a stationary spacetime, you have conservation of mass as you go from one hypersurface to the other one. That seems very plausible. And if you have an axisymmetric spacetime, then you have conservation of angular momentum as you go from one hypersurface to the next. Okay. So basically, all of this is to motivate those definitions over here, that those integrals that I'm defining here in terms of those flux vectors are very good candidates for what we might describe as the flow of mass or the flow of angular momentum across a hypersurface. And to get back to the black hole situation, well, to account for the changes in mass and angular momentum as the matter flows across, well, the definitions basically tell us that in order to do that, all we have to do is to change the hypersurface to be the event horizon and do the calculation for that case. That will describe the amount of mass that transfers across the horizon, and same with the angular momentum. So let's see. So any questions about this? Is that clear to everybody? Okay, so let's now do the final bit and apply this to the horizon. Okay, so we're going back to this situation here. We have an initial time, a final time. Everything is stationary before V1, stationary after V2. We have a flow of matter described by some T mu nu that goes into the event horizon. And then, let's call it the mass flowing into the horizon, I'm going to denote it dmh. That's going to be precisely that integral with the horizon chosen as the hypersurface. So it's going to be a null hypersurface. But otherwise, it's going to be exactly the same integral, and the conservation statement that we derived before didn't really care about the identity of the hypersurfaces. I could have chosen a space-like hypersurface and a null surface. It would have also given rise to a conservation statement. You can think about this, just draw a diagram that would show you this. So basically, I'm saying that the mass that flows here is the mass that we used to have on that slice. It just, by conservation, we get exactly the same amount of mass as described by that integral. And then the angular momentum flowing, that's going to be dJh, and that's going to be exactly the same surface integral, the same hypersurface integral involving the L vector. The only thing that's going to change now is that, well, before I was using an expression for the surface element that was, relevant for a space-like surface. Now I got to choose the right one for a null surface. So now in this application, we're looking at what goes into the horizon. The surface element is going to be the one that points in the direction of the null generator, something that we derived quite some time ago. And V, of course, is the parameter on the null generators, and S is the area element on the cross sections of the event horizon. Okay, so now let's just work with this. In the first law, I sort of erased it, but in the first law, there was this interesting combination of dm minus omega dj. that's what was entering. So let's start with this and see what that gives us. And if I just apply the integral definitions, what we're going to get, so let's specify what this is. So let's just write it in full first. So we get epsilon minus omega L that we integrate. And let's see, do I have those definitions? Yeah, those definitions are there. There's going to be an overall minus sign that I'm going to pull out of the integral. There's going to be a common factor of the stress tensor, so I'll write it like this. And then what do we have here? For E, we get T. And then this minus sign cancels out that minus sign for the second term. So this minus sign becomes this minus sign, and we get omega H phi beta multiplying D sigma alpha inside the integral. So when I consider this linear combination here and work it out explicitly, I get this familiar looking expression involving the two killing vectors that give us the vector k. So all of this amounts to T being dotted with k. And this, we remember, is also directed along k. So I think very interestingly, when we work this out, we kill the two minus signs. What we end up having here is the stress tensor dotted twice with k. And then we integrate over V and integrate over the cross sections. And the interpretation is that, well, the thing that used to be zero for a stationary horizon, well, now is no longer zero because we're, you know, going outside of that stationary situation. That's the thing that contributes to a change, you know, combination of changes that's packaged like this. And the only thing that we have to do now is to work on this and try to see how that relates to a change in area. And that's where our good friend, the Ray-Chowdhury equation, will come back, providing even more of its insights. It will allow us to transform the integral into something that can be evaluated directly without detailed knowledge of what this thing is supposed to be. Right. So for the final steps, I'm going to reinvoke Ray-Chowdhury's equation. So remember, Ray-Chowdhury's equation was a statement in terms of the Ricci scalar, but Ricci tensor, but I can easily do the translation. So this is something that's equal to 1 over 8 pi the Ricci scalar projected twice with the k vector. And by Ray-Chowdhury's equation, there's a factor of 1 over 8 pi that comes in front of everything. What we had was the v derivative of theta plus kappa times theta minus a half theta squared minus sigma ab, shear tensor squared. Okay, so basically the idea is we're going to put that inside the integral and see what we can do with that. Except we're going to remember that what we're doing is a perturbative calculation where the effect of matter is supposed to be small. And in a perturbative calculation, it's okay to work to first order in small quantities, and it's also okay to neglect second order quantities. So theta here, you know, the expansion of our horizon, because the matter flow is small, that's going to be a small quantity. It would be zero in the stationary state. It's now, you know, different from zero, but we're treating theta as being small. If theta is small, then theta squared is going to be very, very small. So we're going to neglect it. And, you know, just thinking a little bit deeper about this, I think will convince you that while the shear tensor is also small because it would be zero for the stationary state, and something like the shear tensor squared is going to be something that also we can neglect. So in the end, we just have to, you know, to deal with just two terms in that equation, both involving theta. And because theta is, you know, a quantity of the first order, it's okay for kappa to be handled at the level of the background spacetime. So kappa can be kept at zeroth order, which means that this kappa is the same kappa that was constant across the event horizon. And that we'll happily use as a way of simplifying our integrals when we do the, you know, the substitution. Okay, so after that, it's just a matter of plugging in the details. So we're back to that combination of changes here. So I'm going to have the factor of 1 over 8 pi. And I have two integrals because I have two terms. So let me just put the first one. I have a minus sign. And inside the second, the first integral, I have dv of theta multiplying dv multiplying ds. So that's the first integral. And then for the second integral, I'll keep the factor of 1 over 8 pi. I will eventually take the kappa out of the integral because it is constant at zeroth order on the horizon, but I'll leave it in for now. And that's multiplying dv ds. All right. Well, we're not too far off. That integral, while I'm, you know, differentiating with respect to v, then integrating with respect to v. So those two operations cancel each other out, and we're going to get boundary terms at v1 and v2. So namely, when I actually do the v integral, what I'll end up with here is an integral purely along s and bounded at v1 and bounded at v2. So basically, I'm just doing, you know, canceling the, I'm doing the v integral knowing that what I'm integrating is something that was differentiated with respect to v. So that's an automatic operation, and I get the two boundary terms. And what survives on the boundary is just the remaining integral of theta and over the cross-section, over the area of the cross-section. And, well, that's zero because I, you know, specified from the start that we're starting from a stationary state, returning to a stationary state, and for those stationary states, theta is equal to zero. So no contributions from the boundary terms. Great. So now we deal with a second integral. Second integral, well, I'm going to reuse the fact that kappa is constant on the horizon. So we're going to get the kappa divided by 8 pi. And now we have the integral of theta dv ds. And, well, that needs to be worked out. And to work this out, we just have to remember a couple of facts that we mentioned before. First of all, the fact that s is the, you know, determinant, the square root of the determinant of the induced metric on the event horizon, the two-dimensional metric omega ab that we've talked about before. So that's the volume, that's the area element on the horizon, the cross section. And then theta, remember, is 1 over that square root times the derivative of that square root with respect to v. Because theta is the fractional rate of change of the cross-sectional areas on the event horizon, and that's measured by this surface element. And all that we do here is basically cancel out the increments in the two coordinates. So that's what theta really stands for in those variables. And if we plug in, you know, everything inside the integral, then this becomes kappa over 8 pi. Then d square root of omega integrated over the two angles. Theta, you know, theta 2, theta 3 are intrinsic coordinates on the horizon, the ones that stay fixed along the generators. All right. Oh, I forgot the DV. Well, now it's the same story all over. We're integrating after we have differentiated. So we're going to get two boundary terms. And this time, of course, they won't be zero. So continuing, we get kappa over 8 pi, and then what do we get? We get the integral of square root of omega d2 theta at the two boundary points, v1 and v2. So we've integrated after having differentiated it. And what is that? Well, that's the area of the event horizon at v2 minus the one at v1, which means that it's equal to the change in area between the starting time and the finishing time. So what do we get from all of this? Well, we get our statement of the first law in the physical process interpretation, where what flows across the event horizon in terms of mass is related to what flows in terms of angular momentum and the change in area in the way that we, you know, worked out before, but now in a very different spirit, where instead of talking about comparing two Kerr solutions, for example, or comparing two stationary spacetimes, we really account for a physical flow of matter across the event horizon, producing changes in mass, producing changes in angular momentum, and relating those changes to the change in area. So all of that follows by, you know, a very simple procedure that, again, requires no knowledge of the metric underlying the black hole spacetime, and is based on, you know, that ultra-powerful equation that we've mentioned many times already, Ray Chowdhury's equation, that keeps track of the relationship between the matter that flows in and what the, you know, the horizon generators do as a consequence. And by just working out this and evaluating the integrals, we end up with, I think, a very nice formulation of the first law. And one that, you know, really can be interpreted as a physical change that happens for one black hole, as opposed to comparing two different black hole spacetimes that are each separately stationary. So different interpretation and different spirit behind it, but of course, in the end, it's all pretty much looking the same. And that's the first law. And of course, with a direct analogy with the first law of thermodynamics, so the dependence on angular momentum is something that you would see for any thermodynamic system that rotates. You would see this kind of situation with a conjugate variable that corresponds to the angular velocity of rotation. So that's something very generic for rotating thermodynamic systems. And then the other term that would be interpreted as a TDS term in a first law, with an analogy between the black hole area playing the role of entropy and the surface gravity playing the role of temperature. And you know the story. At first, the suggestion that was first made by Bekenstein was laughed at, and people, you know, couldn't possibly, agree to that, because a black hole is black. It can never be in thermal equilibrium with anything else. So the analogy was perceived by most to be purely formal at first. But then, you know, the story goes, Hawking came along with Hawking radiation, was able to assign a very meaningful temperature to a black hole. And then, you know, as a result of the first law, was able to assign a meaningful value for the black hole entropy. And we've been wondering about the meaning of this ever since. So very, very deep connection between black hole physics and thermodynamics, all captured by that equation here. Okay, questions about any of this here? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So it would be possible to generalize all of this by allowing the black hole to be charged, and there are some exact solutions that describe that. If you have both rotation and charge, then it would be known as the Kerr-Newman black hole. And there would be a, you know, a, there would be another term in the first law. There would be more terms. There would be another term in the mass law that we saw before that would correspond to the presence of charge. And over here, there would be a, you know, there would be a different term. There would be a, you know, an additional term that would correspond to the change in the charge of the black hole. And there would be a conjugate variable in front that would actually correspond to the, the electrostatic potential evaluated at the event horizon. So that would be the meaning of this this additional potential, this additional quantity that arises in the first law. But yeah, you're right. So in a more general situation, we could allow the charge to change, and that would give rise to another term in the first law. And again, it would be all compatible with what we would do in thermodynamics if we were dealing with a charged system. All right, other questions? Okay, so we've dealt with zeroth and first, so now let's finish off with the second law. Yeah, sure. Oh, if we wanted to derive something like this for something that's not a black hole? Is that your question? Yeah, so then it would look completely different because we wouldn't have, you know, anything like an event horizon to define, you know, meaningful quantities about the, you know, about the object in question. So, there would be no analog of a first law or a second law or a zeroth law for a neutron star, for example. It just doesn't exist. So we really need a black hole to be there in order to. Oh, Tobnut. Yes. Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, so I think there would be additional terms also coming from the nut charge, but I don't remember what it is. I don't haven't looked into that for decades, so I don't remember.
It's also not basically cats.
Yes, that's right. So that would kill the condition of asymptotic flatness, which means that the notion of total mass would be, you know, I think it can still be defined, but it would be a little bit harder. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm sure this has been worked out. And there's been versions of this with cosmological constants and cosmic strings and various, you know, various other additional elements. And, you know, it always looks a little bit like that with extra terms. Okay, so let's talk about the second law. And that one is easy to state. And there's a condition involved. So we have to impose the weak energy condition. I'm sure, I think it's the null energy condition, sorry. And the statement is that the area of an event horizon can never decrease. In any physical process, as we follow it in the future, it will always produce either an increase of area or keep the area the same. And that's, of course, famous from, I think it's the same paper that I talked about, the Hawking paper from 1972, where he proved this along with the other properties that we looked into. All right, so if we're dealing with a stationary black hole, of course, You know, there's no law to speak of. The area would not change if the black hole is stationary. Here we're allowing the black hole to go outside of a stationary state. And the statement is that if it's not, you know, if it's evolving in time, then the area will increase. It will never decrease. And, you know, there's that very important condition that comes with it. And I could give a very mathematical proof of this, but instead what I want to do is to give you a way of thinking about it that's much more physical, and that will, I hope, convince you that it's a consequence of the focusing theorem. So we talked about the focusing theorem, having to do with null geodesics being focused by matter if the null energy condition is satisfied. And it's basically a consequence of this. So let's think about this. And in particular, let's think about the consequence of the fact that if you have geodesics being focused by gravity, and if they start out being converging, then they will converge all the way into a caustic. So what I want to do now is to draw, you know, a few cartoons that will allow us to think about the presence of caustics on event horizons. So it really has to do with caustics and the fact that caustics is the natural state of a congruence of null geodesics that is being focused by gravity. So just to remember, if we have a situation, so the focusing theorem, let's remember what it says. The focusing theorem says that under the weak energy condition or the null energy condition, the rate of change of the expansion along a null generator, and here I'll go back to the affine parameterization description of this, that's got to be non-positive. So geodesics are being focused. We've talked a lot about this. And on top of that, it says that if we pick a generator and we notice that for the initial state, there's a bundle of light rays that are converging, namely that the cross-section is getting smaller and smaller. If we start from that state, then at some finite affine parameter later, we're going to reach a state where theta will reach minus infinity in finite lambda. And that's the statement that if we have a bundle of geodesics that is converging at any moment of time, then it will converge all the way to the formation of a caustic. So this means that under those conditions, we have no choice. Under the focusing action of gravity, that bundle of geodesics will terminate into a singular point that we call a caustic. And because a caustic is a singular point in the flow, what happens to the flow beyond the caustic is not something that can be controlled. So we can describe the congruence up to the caustic formation. After that, well, you know, it's like predicting the future from singular initial conditions. There's no way you can do it. It's unpredictable beyond that. So what happens beyond that point is unpredictable. And that's something that will be important in that discussion. Okay. So caustics can be found on event horizons. And we can recognize caustics being formed when the event horizon itself is being formed. So let's go back to our cartoon diagram where we have the collapsing star. And now I'm going to make some attempt to draw it in 3D. Well, 2D. So we have the collapsing star that forms a singularity. And then, you know, we have this transition between light rays being able to escape, light rays being captured, and the marginal case in between where the light rays are being focused to a stationary state. And we can trace those light rays to a point at the center of the star, and that point is a caustic. So because I'm drawing a 3D picture, I have a whole bunch of geodesics that are all emanating from the same central point inside the star at the same time. So all of those geodesics that are tracing out the event horizon, all initiated from that one event at that very specific moment in time, where those light rays that are now being emitted at that moment will get captured by the gravity of the collapsing star and form the event horizon at some later time. Well, the horizon starts right here. And that is a caustic. And what we could do here is to actually follow the light rays beyond the formation point. We can trace them backwards in time. And basically, we're thinking of light rays being generated from the center. But in fact, we could think of them as being, you know, coming in from a given direction, passing through the center, and emerging on the other side. Right? So if I draw a sort of spatial view of this, that's the center of the star. But a light ray just came in from one direction and came out again on the opposite direction, and it, you know, and then eventually got captured by the gravitational field. So that point here is not a point where necessarily the light rays, you know, started. The light rays could have started before. Well, that point over here is not terribly important, but what I'm saying is that we could think of those light rays as, you know, being extended to the past beyond the caustic. But nevertheless, we still have a caustic, and a caustic is very much, you know, what happens. You know, it's pretty much always guaranteed to happen when you form an event horizon in the first place by following a gravitational collapse. There will be that creation event. May not be at a point if we're not in spherical symmetry. It might be a, you know, some kind of, you know, more complicated shape. But the point is that, you know, because the event horizon forms at a given time, there will be a creation event. And that creation event will be where all the light rays come out, and it has to come out from a caustic, because that's a point where all the expanding, you know, all the light rays are expanding and, being launched from that event over here. So they basically all correspond to an expansion parameter that started out at plus infinity, and then eventually theta gets reduced. And gets reduced to zero by the focusing action of the matter and gravity. So the point that I'm trying to make here is that it's very usual for caustics to be found on the event horizon, but they always occur at, you know, at a formation event like this. They always occur in the past. I'm going to give you another example of this, where we can have a past caustic, and that happens when a black hole merges with another black hole. That also comes with a creation event where new generators enter the event horizon at another caustic. So I'm going to talk about this for a minute, but what I want to introduce here is an idea that caustics are, you know, possible on event horizons, but they're always possible in the past, they're impossible in the future. And that's going to be the basis for the area theorem. So just bear with me when we go through that story. So let me try to draw a space-time diagram that would show the merger of two black holes. And I'm not very talented with drawing, so I'll do my best here. So here's one black hole that's moving to the right. And here's another black hole that's moving to the left. And they're merging. They're merging to form a bigger black hole. So that's the structure of the event horizon. I'm forgetting about, you know, the gravitational collapse that occurred here at some point. I'm, you know, forgetting about that here. I'm interested in the merger event. Here's the point where the two black holes come together. And let's imagine tracing some generators. So the event horizon is traced by generators. So here's one, here's another one, here's another one, and it keeps going like this. And then that part of the event horizon was also traced by null generators. But the point is that here, when the black hole merges, the black holes merge, we have another type of creation event where it's possible for new generators to join in. So that's another singular point where we can get new generators coming in and those emanate right at the crotch right here. And, you know, in the future, they will live in perfect harmony with the generators that used to be there. But at that moment over here, new generators pop in. And that's a caustic. And that's also a point where theta at that caustic is equal to plus infinity, because we have a whole bunch of new generators all coming in from the same point. May not be a point, it might be a, you know, a different structure, but it all comes in, you know, from a singular place, and it all emerges from that, emanates from that, and that's, you know, a caustic where theta goes to, you know, starts out at plus infinity, and then, you know, immediately it goes down to a finite value to the future. So we can get new generators like this, and if we follow those new generators to the past, well, what we would find, like those ones over here, is that, well, those ones continue on but in the past, they were never part of the two horizons that were there to begin with. They were out of the event horizon, and it's only at the creation event over here that they now join into the event horizon. So in the past, they were still light rays that eventually ended up here, but those light rays were outside of the event horizon. Same with those light rays over here that can be, you know, that were there before the creation event. But those light rays were never part of the event horizon until the creation event right here. Same story over here. So that's another example where we can have a caustic, and that's a, you know, familiar occurrence. You know, all the people that do black hole simulations and merge them, well, they end up with caustics like this at you know, merger events like that. So that's, you know, that's a very frequently occurring thing in dynamical situations involving black holes. So conclusion here is that, well, those are two examples. I could show more of that stuff. The conclusion is that caustics, and what I mean is events where theta is positively infinite, can occur on an event horizon, but in the past. I want to convince you that they can't occur in the future. And what I mean by that is, well, what if instead of a merger, we had a bifurcation? A black hole decided to, you know, pop into two separate black holes in some kind of, you know, destruction event, whatever. So let's imagine what would happen if that were allowed. So let's suppose that we have something like the time reversal of this. We started out with one big black hole, and then we ended up with two separate black holes. Looking like that. So that would be, well, it's no longer a creation event, it's more like, you know, a destruction event. And that would have to be, you know, another caustic, but now it's a future caustic instead of a past caustic. And we can start, you know, tracing the generators. So some of the generators of, you know, the left black hole could be traced to the past like this, and they were always part of the event horizon. Some of those generators were also always past, you know, always part of the event horizon. But now we have generators that come to an end over here. So instead of gaining new generators, now we lose generators through a caustic. So that's another caustic. It's a caustic where now the generators are coming together with, you know, converging together. So with theta that goes to minus infinity instead of plus infinity. And the issue is, what would happen to those generators if we follow them in the future? And what would happen is exactly what happened over there, except now it happens in the future. Those generators, as they're followed beyond the caustic, would no longer be part of the event horizon. And where would those generators go? Well, maybe some of them would go somewhere else, but some of them will go to infinity. So what would we have? We would have light rays that, through a future caustic, manage to escape to future infinity. And therefore, we would have signals that originate from the event horizon reaching out to observers at infinity. And that violates the very idea that we're dealing with a black hole. It's simply contradictory. So those, so a future caustic, that would lead to light rays reaching infinity. And therefore, it would invalidate the notion, or the, I would say that the definition of a black hole as a causal boundary. I should say the event horizon as a causal boundary. So basically, we're violating the idea that the black hole event horizon shields us from anything that happens either on it or inside it. Nothing can reach infinity if they originated from inside or from the event horizon itself. If we allowed for future caustics, because we can't guarantee what would happen to the light rays beyond the, you know, beyond the caustic, we could not guarantee that those light rays don't go to infinity. In other words, some of those light rays continued beyond the caustic would in fact find their way to infinity, and that would violate the very notion of a black hole. So, the idea is that if we want to retain this idea of black holes, we have to basically rule out those future caustics. And there's a way to formalize this. It's not a proof. There's no proof that according to the laws of general relativity, future caustics cannot happen. There's a conjecture that's called the cosmic censorship conjecture that states that a black hole event horizon can have past caustics, but will never have future caustics. In other words, it's being traced by null generators that can have past endpoints, but no future endpoints. So cosmic censorship is the statement that basically says it's a conjecture, but it basically is the central notion around the, you know, robustness of the future existence of event horizons. It states that past caustics are okay, but future caustics are impossible or ruled out. In other words, generators can have a past endpoint. They can originate from a caustic event where theta goes to plus infinity, but they will never terminate. They don't have an endpoint. Future endpoint, they will never terminate at a caustic where theta goes to minus infinity. If we want to preserve the notion of an event horizon as the way it's conventionally defined, we have to basically, you know, ask the laws of nature to enforce cosmic censorship. If we do that, then we get the second law. So after all of this, we're ready to face the second law. And it's basically putting the impossibility of this with the inevitability of that together, right? So that's the final step. So we have two statements. The first one is that future caustics cannot happen. That's the one that's, you know, provided to us by cosmic censorship. If we allowed that to happen, then the notion of an event horizon would just go down the drain. It would not be a valid, you know, description of a black hole. So the first statement is that theta cannot go to minus infinity on the event horizon. That's the cosmic censorship requirement. And then there's the other statement that we came to before that says that acoustic will happen if theta is ever found to be negative on any one generator. So if we allow this, we get this, but we don't want it. So the only way out is to declare that we don't want that. So if we don't want this, we cannot have that. If we cannot have that, we can we can't have an area that decreases. Because let's remember the area evolution law that we wrote down before, the way that the area changes with advanced time v is that it's given by an integral over the cross section of the event horizon of the expansion parameter. If theta is guaranteed to be positive or non-negative everywhere on the horizon, then we get that the area must increase. If the area, if the expansion were positive somewhere and negative somewhere else, we couldn't conclude anything. But if the expansion is positive everywhere, well, we know that, well, that means that the fractional rate of change of the area is positive. And that means that after integration, that the area as a whole will be increasing. So those two things together guarantee that if we want to preserve the notion of a black hole, it's got to be that for all the generators that exist on an event horizon, that they have a non-zero, non-negative rate of expansion. It's either zero in the stationary case, or it's positive in the evolving case. And if it's indeed positive, then the integral is positive, and that means that the area will increase. And that's the second law. So basically, just to say it again, if we allowed for a situation where some bundles of null generators were allowed to converge, that would create a caustic in the future. And if we had that future caustic, we couldn't guarantee the causal properties of the event horizon, and that would spoil the notion of a black hole. It would spoil everything that we want the black hole to be. Now, nature could do that. There's no evidence that it does. And we declare that it won't do that by saying that cosmic censorship prevents it. And someday, perhaps, we'll have a proof of cosmic censorship that will show that the laws of physics, according to general relativity, necessarily enforce that. We don't have that yet. So we don't know that cosmic censorship is necessarily enforced in four-dimensional gravity, according to Einstein's theory. So, but if we say that it is, then this behavior cannot occur, and this behavior cannot occur only if we can guarantee that the expansion is everywhere non-negative on the event horizon. And if that's true, then we can guarantee that the area will increase in the future. And that's basically it. So all of this can be formalized. And that's what Hawking did, but I think the physical ideas are much more important. And I think to understand the origin, the origin of that statement, the origin of that law, I think is really important. And I think the cartoons do an awful lot in that direction. So that's why I presented it this way. So it's a mixture of just drawing cartoons, deciding what would happen in the future of a caustic, and then just filling in with a little bit of math to back this up. But the math in the end is very, it's very mild, but of course it relies on all the knowledge that we've accumulated. So all this stuff that we've talked about comes in again, and that's how we can dispense of the math so quickly, and then it's all done. So we have zeroth law, first law, second law. In my book, I have a section on a third law, which is a statement to the effect that the surface gravity of a black hole cannot be reduced down to zero in a finite sequence of operations. But as of last year, the third law has been disproved, so I don't think you need to pay attention to that one. Although the reasons for all of that are still something I need to understand better. Yeah, so you have a question?
So does this imply that we're assuming that black holes can never die, they can never decay?
Right, so now the question is, what happens when you put in the Hawking radiation? And what does the Hawking radiation do? Well, you know the cartoon picture is that you create pairs of particles with quantum mechanics, and some of them escape to infinity, some of them gets absorbed by the horizon. And what gets absorbed actually comes with negative energy and contributes to shrink the event horizon. So the event horizon shrinks, and that's compensated by the flow of Hawking radiation at infinity. And eventually there comes to a point where the horizon becomes, basically evaporates to, an unknown final state. So here, clearly, we're dealing with a violation of the Airy law. And Hawking basically provided his own violation of the Airy law. And that has to do with the fact that the Hawking flux across the event horizon, the particles that come through the horizon, don't satisfy the weak energy condition or the null energy condition. So you violate the energy condition. So that's just something that happens. And then people talk about, there must be some generalized entropy that accounts for the entropy of the black hole and the entropy of the stuff that's contained in the Hawking radiation, and maybe the sum of entropies is always increasing, and it looks as if we have a decent proof of this. So there is a generalized second law that says that the total entropy of the black hole, that includes the area plus the entropy contained in the Hawking radiation, all of that increases with time as the Hawking evaporation process continues. So that sort of saves the day. But nevertheless, what happens at the final moment, and whether you have to give up on the notion of a black hole anyway, because in the end they will evaporate to something that's no longer a black hole, so the event horizon will disappear, presumably. That means that cosmic censorship is not something that can be expected to hold forever. It might hold almost to the end of the black hole evaporation process, but presumably it's going to be violated there. But, that's okay. When we talk about black hole evaporation, we're really talking about quantum gravity, especially toward the end, where everything becomes very, very, very high curvature. And cosmic censorship was never meant to apply to a quantum gravity situation. It's meant to apply to a classical gravity situation. So, you can sort of reconcile all of those notions, but it can get weird when you incorporate some quantum ideas into a classical picture and try to put everything together in something that makes sense. It can be a challenge. So I think that was your question. Yeah. Okay, so that was the end of the road for me. So any questions before we quit for the day and for forever? Yep. If you had a little,
like a tiny black hole, just kind of like combat. So this kind of paragraphs picture, but one event arises lots of them.
Right, but then do you imagine that it disappears?
Oh, like I said. Yeah.
Right. So I mean, you in principle, you could.
Yeah.
Pop a black hole from the vacuum, and there's speculation that in the early universe you might have spontaneous creation of black holes, and those are called primordial black holes, and it would basically be a random quantum quantum vacuum event where from the vacuum you end up with a black hole. So that's fine. So that doesn't violate any of this, although it's still rooted in a quantum process. But if you allow that using quantum ideas, you probably should allow for the time reversal event. So black holes could pop in and pop out again, and that would sort of violate those notions. So it's, yeah. So you can accept some, but you have to reject some too. Yep?
Speaking of propagation in the present, as far as I understand, it's like the effect of the two particles where the negative one falls in and the positive one falls out. Why does it seem to, it sounds to me like we're favoring the bulk of the particles that are on the boundary that we're memorizing, the bulk of them that are negative mass are falling in, the bulk of them, you know, why is it not equally random?
Right. So I have an answer to this, but the first part of the answer is really that this pair creation cartoon picture is a cartoon, right? So the exact origin of the Hawking radiation is something that can be described in quantum field theory, and there's really no notion of, you know, real particles being created out of out of the vacuum into existence. So that's basically a convenient quantum picture that we can use to explain roughly what's going on, but it's not to be taken literally. What can be taken literally is the fact that the Hawking out of this quantum field description of the process, we have an outgoing flux of positive energy and an ingoing flux of negative energy. So that is something that is described in the quantum field that produces the effect, and it can be calculated, and you can really, show that it's positive in one direction, negative in the other direction. If you go back to the cartoon picture and ask why is it that the negative energy particles never escape, is because that negative energy particles are not allowed to live in the space-time. So and that has to do with the fact that the time-like killing vector changes sign on the event horizon. If we're talking about a Schwarzschild black hole. So you can have negative energy states inside because the killing vector goes space-like, and you can have both signs. Outside, it's got to be a future-pointing momentum vector, and the energy has to be positive. Otherwise, it couldn't travel in the exterior. So that's a way of sort of thinking about this in the cartoon picture, but again, it's probably not worth spending too much time trying to work it out in detail because it's basically just a cartoon.
Okay.